off here with, I think only the first two articles are even really remotely linked to the present, just to get you into the position of this and understanding and being reminded of the people that we're talking about. And then we're going to start going back and talking about some of the roots of these and the connections, of course, the all-important connections of these various groups. Specifically, we're going to be talking about the umbrella group that goes under the name Aryan Nations. And the first article that we're going to be reading from is an article by Toby Hatley, T-O-B-B-Y-H-A-T-L-E-Y, from the Portland Oregonian of November 18th, 1984. And research credit to this for Mae Brussel, who obtained this. Quote, "The whites are self-evidently the leaders, the light bearers of the world. That's the law order of God." The Reverend Richard G. Butler pauses to think while he fishes a cigarette from the crumpled pack of Pall Malls and lights it. After taking a deep drag, the spiritual and political leader of a small congregation of North Idaho white supremacists exhales a cloud of blue smoke and continues, quote, "The only thing that the blacks and Asians have ever had is what they were first taught by us. The white race has been the culture bearers. They have been the civilizing influence of the world." Unquote. Skipping down through the article. For the past 11 years, Richard Butler and his followers, secure, 5 miles east of Hayden, which is Hayden, Idaho, on their 20-acre tract of forested land, an enclave complete with guard towers, a church building, printing presses, and a rifle range, have been putting out the word against Jews, Catholics, blacks, Mexican-Americans, homosexuals, communism, and the American economic system. They punctuate their message with white supremacist rhetoric, Nazi salutes, and cross burnings. Local, state, and federal authorities keep tabs on the comings and goings of self-proclaimed members of neo-Nazi organizations, the Ku Klux Klan, the Posse Comitatus, and the Christian Defense League who live at or visit the guarded hideaway. At least 4 members of the area's tiny minority population and 1 law enforcement officer have been threatened. Buildings have been blown up and vandalized, and Aryan Nations members have been arrested. But no one has been hurt physically. Okay, skipping down. Talking now about a gathering that took place of these several different people. Several different groups that sort of, if they're not actually members of Aryan Nations, they see a common thread in Aryan Nations and use it as a meeting place or a contact point. Referring to this gathering, it says, at the gathering were Robert Miles, former Grand Dragon of the Michigan KKK, Don Black, a Grand Dragon of the KKK from Alabama, Edward Arlt, A-R-L-T, an Aryan Nations official from Texas, and Alexei Erlanger, spelled E-R-L-A-N-G-R, Alexei Erlanger, a leader of the Liberation Movement of the German Reich, located in Buffalo, New York. Okay, so Don Black there, Robert Miles, KKK officials, an Aryan Nations official from Texas, and Alexei Erlanger from the Liberation Movement for the German Reich in Buffalo, and we're going to talk a little bit more about that in a moment.
Okay, now, one of the things to remember here is that these Nazis here, one of the points that we're making here, have some connections, albeit, at least from the information available, relatively slight, at least for what's come to the surface, with German Nazis. Now, Alexei Erlanger of the German-American League here, basically, the, what is the name of this organization?
It was the... Preservation of the Reich for the...
Liberation Movement of the German Reich.
Right, okay. Out of Buffalo.
Basically, Erlanger has had some contact with a couple of original Third Reich alumni, Hans Ulrich Rudel, a very famed German pilot, and Otto Skorzeny, SS man, and basically one of the top Nazi war heroes, Hitler's personal favorite, rescuer of Mussolini, and a lot of other interesting pieces of derring do.
And just to be filed for future reference, a very important German for the CIA later on, and we'll probably get into that at some later point.
Right. We've talked about him. Skorzeny is chronicled in considerable detail on our Radio Free America show, number 3, actually. He's number 3 about the Galen organization, has quite a bit about Skorzeny. Anyway, reading now from a book called Aftermath, authored by Ladislas Farago, F-A-R-A-G-O, former U.S. intelligence agent. It's about Martin Bormann and the Nazi exile community in Latin America. The book was published in softcover by Avon Press, copyright 1974. There's also a Simon & Schuster hardcover edition out of Aftermath. Once again, author Ladislas Farago. He writes as follows. Talking about a publication called a Die Brücke, or The Bridge in German, he writes, in the same issue, which also campaigned to have Rudolf Hess released from Spandau, President Wilfred A. Kernbach, K-E-R-N-B-A-C-H of Chicago, proudly announced that Alexei Erlanger, E-R-L-A-N-G-E-R, of the Buffalo chapter, was heading a drive to bring, quote, two famous German war heroes to the USA for a visit of our military institutions and our German community, unquote. One of the invited guests was Hans Ulrich Rudel. The other was Otto Skorzeny. We're bringing this up, this connection between the Third Reich people and these American, quote, neo-Nazis, unquote, because what we're going to try to show on this broadcast and on the next two is that essentially Nazi doings in Germany, fascist doings in the United States, have essentially been produced by the same people, acting in much of the same manner through the same power structures on both sides of the Atlantic. And we're going to, particularly on tonight's broadcast, attempt to correlate the development of Nazism in this country and the development of Nazism in Germany. And we're going to trace this up through the years, and we're going to show how the Aryan Nations grew out of this particular organization. But remember, the purpose of presenting this particular information is that here, the Aryan Nations, this umbrella organization of domestic Nazis, who are being so lightly dismissed as, you know, a bunch of roughnecks, a bunch of, you know, rednecks or what have you, they're actually were forming at this point contacts, and this being 1973, contacts with some of the top Third Reich alumni, and that's worth keeping in mind.
Not only domestic Nazis, but also, of course, some foreign ones, too, and there are still foreign Nazis, even in West Germany, a country of all countries that should be a little worried about having their neo-Nazis running about, and they are, presumably. Anyway, this is a short segment from an article from the San Jose Mercury News for Sunday, January 27th, 1985, an article entitled A Holy War Built on Hate, the author John Huebner, a San Jose Mercury staff writer. In the middle of the article, he's talking about an Aryan Nations 1982 conference. It says, Manfred Roeder, R-O-E-D-E-R, the head of the largest neo-Nazi group in Europe, attended the 1982 conference. Roeder was then a fugitive from West Germany, where he was wanted for the bombing of a Vietnamese refugee center that killed two people. Roeder returned to West Germany and is now serving a prison sentence. In his absence, his wife, Traudel, T-R-A-U-D-E-L, has attended the last three conclaves. So Manfred Roeder is indeed the leader of the largest European neo-Nazi organization, and he, at least among other people, seems to find the hospitality of the Aryan Nation folks hospitable.
Okay. Now, basically, this particular group here, the Aryan Nations, have, as I said, formed links with German Nazis over a period of time, and we've just taken a look at two contemporary links, both with Third Reich alumni and with some, quote, neo-Nazis from Germany. Remember this, because we're going to, as I said, we're going to try and trace the development of German and American fascism back to the same, many of the same influences and involving some of the same institutions. Now, in order to understand how all of these connections fit together, you have to understand that the Aryan Nations is what we're talking about, I should say, by the Aryan Nations. What we're really referring to here is an umbrella organization, an amalgam, sort of a changing intersection of various names and organizations, which in fact appear to be, if not the same organization, so closely intersected that it would not be unrealistic to think of them as being essentially the same organization. Some of the names, you know, these organizations are not coterminous. In other words, they're not exactly the same, but they have such a large intersection that from a practical standpoint, it's useful to think of them as being essentially the same group. Now, some of the names that we're really referring to by the term Aryan Nations consist of the Posse Comitatus, which is a violently right-wing, particularly anti-income tax group. And remember the opposition to the income taxes. We're going to come back to that in connection with some other people we're going to see here. The Identity is one of the groups to keep in mind. And we're going to come back to these in a few minutes. Also, the Christian Defense League, which is the military wing of something called the Church of Jesus Christ Christian. These are basically the things to bring in mind here, the things to keep in mind here, I should say. Okay? Now, sort of by way of launching our discussion here of the Aryan Nations, we're going to take a look at the Reverend Richard Butler, who was in the article that Nip Tuck just read you, and the fellow who basically was his mentor and sort of got him started in the neo-Nazi movement. That was a guy named Dr. Wesley Swift, last name S-W-I-F-T. Remember that, because we're going to come back to Wesley Swift. He's going to be one of the threads that ties a lot of this tangle of events and organizations together. I'd like to read you a short section from an article in the San Francisco Sunday Chronicle Examiner and Chronicle from January 27th, 1985. This article is headlined, A Chilling Look into the Neo-Nazi Fortress. It's by Ivan Sharp, an Examiner staff writer. Just going to read you a short section of this and about the Aryan Nations, about the Church of Jesus Christ Christian and the Christian Defense League, and Wesley Swift and Richard Butler. Sharp writes as follows. A former Lockheed aeronautical engineer, Butler turned racist preacher after his mentor, Dr. Wesley Swift of Lancaster, died in 1971. 2 years later, he moved his Church of Jesus Christ Christian Aryan Nations to the Idaho Panhandle. The Anti-Defamation League of B'nai B'rith said Butler also served as national director of the Christian Defense League in Lancaster, which it called a right-wing paramilitary hate group involved in the buying and stockpiling of large amounts of weapons. So, again, Wesley Swift is the mentor and the predecessor of, the fellow who founded the Aryan Nations and its religious arm, the Church of Jesus Christ Christian, is Wesley Swift. Butler takes over from him. But remember the names Identity, Posse Comitatus, Christian Defense League, Church of Jesus Christ Christian. We're going to tie all of these groups in with the John Birch Society, with the Ku Klux Klan, the American Nazi Party of George Lincoln Rockwell, and a lot of other things. Again, it's sort of long-winded, but what we really have is one group, in essence, operating under a lot of different names. So some of those names and some of those groups and some of the intersections are going to be in an article which Nip read some time ago, but we're going to reproduce for you.
Indeed, and this is going to be treating largely with Identity and the founding thereof. And this was originally aired on One Step Beyond on June 12, 1983. And this is, again, an article or series of articles, isn't it? It's more than one, or is it just the one large one?
This actually, in this particular tape segment, is just going to be one article from June 11th of 1983 from the New York Times.
Okay. And, again, so you're going to hear the voice. It may sound a little different because it's on tape, but it is, in fact, the same folks doing the same stuff for the hopefully same good purpose. And we will be back after this to do some more live reading. So once again, June 12, 1983 from One Step Beyond, and the information should be fairly self-explanatory, especially if you've just been listening to what we've just been talking about. And Wesley Swift, the mentor of Reverend Butler, who is the current head of Aryan Nations.
First article is titled, Link Seen Among Heavily Armed Rightist Groups. And this is from the New York Times for Saturday, June 11th, the one with a big picture of Margaret Thatcher, Attila the Hun, shaking hands with all of her constituents in Britain. The article is by Wayne King. Once again, the headline is Link Seen Among Heavily Armed Rightist Groups. And I'm just going to read bits and snippets from this article. The federal authorities investigating the gun battles that led to the death of the tax protester Gordon W. Kahl, K-A-H-L, say they are uncovering troubling links among groups of heavily armed right-wing extremists, cutting across organizational lines, from the Nazi Party and the Ku Klux Klan to radical elements of the farm protest movement. Adherents, armed in some cases with explosives, grenade launchers, and automatic and semi-automatic weapons, and trained in guerrilla warfare tactics, are said by these authorities to be bound by violent anti-Semitism, rabid anti-communism, revisionist Christianity, and beliefs that taxation is illegal and that currency is debased by an amorphous conspiracy of Jews, bankers, communists, their dupes, and corrupt government officials. The link among the disparate right-wing groups is not organizational, and you can put a little nip-tuck asterisk after that. I wouldn't say it's necessarily not organizational, but anyway. The link among the disparate right-wing groups is not organizational, but ideological and theological. A common thread is violently racist religious teachings like those of a California-based organization called the Ministry of Christ Church, which is known to its adherents as Identity, after its quarterly newsletter of that name. Among other things, the church teaches that Jews are children of Satan and should be exterminated. The church is closely associated with Posse Comitatus, the radical anti-tax, switch pages here, the radical anti-tax group, with which Mr. Kahl was affiliated. The loosely knit extremist connection is said to be nationwide, but concentrated in small enclaves in the Middle and Far West and in Arkansas, where Mr. Kahl found refuge in a bunker-style safe house owned by far-right theological kinsmen. Such links are also being reported by the Anti-Defamation League of the B'nai B'rith. Concern because of the group's violent anti-Semitism, and by a well-placed and knowledgeable former activist in right-wing extremist groups. A 16-page report, prepared by Anti-Defamation League staff members who regularly monitor the right-wing, was made public this week. It focused on the identity movement, saying the church's, quote, ideological thread of bigotry was shared by extremist groups that include the Posse Comitatus, the Christian Defense League, the Aryan Nations, the Christian Patriots Defense League, and elements of the Ku Klux Klan and the Nazi Party. Well, with the 4th of July coming up, you folks might want to prepare to invite all them folks to your 4th of July bomb block party, because they sound like a bunch of good old Americans. Anyway, skipping on down the article, quote, the people who sheltered Gordon Kahl in Arkansas were not members of Posse Comitatus, said 51-year-old Kurt Saxon, what a great name, a former Californian who is a leader of the survivalist movement and who now lives in the Arkansas Hills, some 60 miles from the bunker where Mr. Kahl was killed last week. Quote, they were members of another right-wing group, he said, but they were also identity. Now, the Klan is totally identity. I don't care what label they use, they are identity. Identity being adherence of the Ministry of Christ Church that we mentioned earlier. I don't care what label they use, they are identity. Most of the Nazi groups are total identity. I don't care what label they use, they are identity. Now, skipping on down, this is a paragraph subheaded, Identity Leader Visited. When reached by telephone last Saturday at his mountain retreat at Harrison, Arkansas, the day after the deadly confrontation between Mr. Kahl and the sheriff at Walnut Ridge, 60 miles away, Mr. Saxon had just concluded a visit with the Reverend William Potter Gale, the founder of the Ministry of Christ Church, the leader of the identity movement. Both men said the visit was sheer coincidence and had nothing to do with Mr. Kahl's presence in Arkansas. Quote, from what he said, he and his wife were on vacation, Mr. Saxon said of Mr. Gale. He didn't know Kahl. I don't think he had any knowledge of the bunker at all. Gale's contact nearest to Kahl was Wickstrom. And, of course, even Wickstrom wouldn't have known anything about it. Mr. Saxon referred to James P. Wickstrom, the national organizer of Posse Comitatus. Founded in 1969 by an Oregon man who was a member of the pro-Nazi Silver Shirts in the 1930s, the posses are ostensibly locally based tax protest groups that believe no governmental agency above the county level has any legal authority. The Latin words Posse Comitatus mean power of the county. The local groups are affiliated nationally through the Posses of America, based in Tigerton, Wisconsin, and headed by Mr. Wickstrom, a 40-year-old self-styled Christian minister. His title is Director of Counterinsurgency for Posses of America, and his message is violent, anti-Semitic, anti-black, anti-communist, and anti-government above the county level. In alliance with Mr. Gale, whose military career included service on General Douglas MacArthur's staff and supervision in guerrilla operations in the Philippines in World War II, Mr. Wickstrom has sponsored a series of, quote, counterinsurgency seminars around the country, mostly in the Middle West and West. In a typical three-day session in Weskin, Kansas, monitored and described by the Office of the Kansas Attorney General, Robert Stephen, 56 participants were trained as, quote, killer teams in hand-to-hand combat techniques, the administration of poisons, night combat patrol, and murder by ambush. Skipping on down, Inspector Kupferer of the Marshal Service said, there has been some information that they are into RPGs, rocket-propelled grenades, mortars, explosive and protective equipment, heavy-duty armor, that type of thing. And so, with some of the information we got with some of their training grounds and tactics, it fits. Okay, now, some stuff to consider about this before we go and examine some of the more in-depth sections and specifically talk about that omission that I alluded to earlier. You notice that what we're talking about here, now they're talking about, and they talk about a theological and ideological link as opposed to an organizational link between these various groups, the Aryan Nations, the Posse Comitatus, et cetera, et cetera. However, as we go back and we examine the roots of some of these groups, now they did mention the Silver Shirt springing up in the 30s. As we go back and examine the roots of some of these groups, you will notice that not only is there a definite link as they said, ideologically and theologically, but they've been around a long time, and the leadership tends to overlap quite a bit. And not only that, as we'll find out, but they have been in the past agents of foreign governments also, which is interesting to note. And we will look into that, too. The first thing I'm going to read...
Okay, again, that was a section from June 12, 1983, from A One Step Beyond. And yes, as mentioned in the past, they have been agents of foreign governments, and we will look at that as well. Number of things to think about, but first off, I should mention to you that you are listening to KFJC 89.7 Los Altos Hills.
Okay, now, in that particular article that Niptuck just read you via Oxide, again, from the New York Times, June 11th, 1983, a couple of things to remember. Remember the name William Potter Gale, G-A-L-E, head of the Christian Defense League and Church of Jesus Christ Christian. We're going to come right back to him. Remember also that the founder of the Posse Comitatus was a fellow who belonged to an organization called the Silver Shirts. Now, the Silver Shirts were headed up by a man named William Dudley Pelley, P-E-L-L-E-Y. We're going to talk about him later in the broadcast. But remember the link between the Silver Shirts and the Posse Comitatus, that the founder of the Posse Comitatus was a former Silver Shirt, because these tributaries leading between these various organizations, past and present, are going to be one of the main focuses of the broadcast this evening. Now, we're going to be focusing primarily on two elements as sort of the epicenters of fascism, one of the main epicenters of fascism, both in the United States and in Germany. Now, one of the things we're going to be taking a look at with regard to the United States is essentially the staff of General Douglas MacArthur, the hero of the Philippines and, of course, one of America's great military heroes of World War II. Without passing judgment on MacArthur personally, his role appears to have some ambiguities. It can certainly be said without a doubt that General MacArthur, his staff, was an epicenter of American fascism almost throughout the entire course of his military career. In looking over the ranks of the various far right-wing and fascist groups in this country, many, many, many tributaries run back to various people from the staff of General Douglas MacArthur, and William Gale is one of them. We're going to talk about him in just a second. The other thing we want to call attention, your attention to right now, is the participation and the influence of the Morgan Financial and Industrial Group. Now, in a nutshell, basically, there are two basic types of business entrepreneurs, industrial capitalists and finance capitalists. Now, J.P. Morgan, of course, was a very great banker, and the Morgan Bank was one of the dominant commercial banks in the United States for many years. Still is. The Morgans capitalized in turn, among others, they contributed a great deal of money to the DuPont industrial empire. Now, the DuPonts, of course, are the family that owns DuPont Chemical Company, the largest chemical company in this country. Something which a lot of people are not aware of is that DuPonts also own General Motors. In order to give some competition to Henry Ford's automotive empire, basically, with financing from the Morgans, the DuPonts bought up a bunch of defunct car companies or failing car companies, combined them into General Motors, and that is how General Motors came into being. It's also one reason why you always get your GM, your DuPont products with your GM cars. Okay, they're owned by the same people. So when we're talking about the Morgan Financial and Industrial Group, we're talking about the Morgan Bank, DuPont Chemicals, General Motors, related industries, also some Wall Street firms, Kuhn and Loeb, Dillon and Reed, and also some law firms on Wall Street like Sullivan and Cromwell, which do a lot of work with them. That's what we're talking about here. But the Morgan Group, as we saw in Uncle Sam and the Swastika, was intimately involved, and we're going to review some of that material tonight, intimately involved in not only financing Nazi Germany and some of the political events going on there, but also in arming Nazi Germany, and the Morgan Group was very active in the United States as well in promoting fascism.
Okay, and again, bear in mind, this is a very complicated set of connections here between these things, and again, this is one of the reasons why we're putting this all together on tape, but essentially we're talking about an umbrella organization that's being called Identity, founded by William Potter Gale, that, as you heard, Kurt Saxon, as was read in the article, which really is just a great name for an Aryan right-winger, Kurt Saxon referred to as saying, well, these groups may not say that their identity, but their identity. Okay, we've been talking about the Aryan Nations, okay, and the springboard for Aryan Nations. Aryan Nations Reverend Richard Butler is the head of Aryan Nations, which is currently holding its big powwows out in northern Idaho and near Hayden, Idaho. And we're talking also, we've talked about Wesley Swift, who is the man who was the inspiration for Butler to go on and found his own Aryan Nation. So those are the three main names at this point we're talking about in terms of the founding spirits and a lot of other names revolving around them. William Potter Gale, who we're going to be concentrating on coming right up, Butler, the founder of Aryan Nations, and Wesley Swift, the guiding light and the mentor of Reverend Butler.
Absolutely. And, of course, remember also the Silver Shirts. We're coming back to that a little later. Now, about William Potter Gale, the head of the Church of Jesus Christ Christian, founder of the Christian Defense League, an article appeared about him in the evening edition of the San Jose Mercury News on January 11th of 1984. This article is by Kevin Moran. I think that may be a woman, K-E-V-I-N-N-E. A Mercury staff writer, the article is headlined, "We'll Bury You," Dateline, Mariposa, California. Reading a short section of this article, again, people are inclined to dismiss these people as an insignificant force. Although this is not hard, it's not confirmed information, consider the following. When asked for an estimate of his following, Gale replied that the FBI several years ago credited him with 6 million to 8 million followers. The FBI didn't confirm or deny that figure. A Freedom of Information request by the San Jose Mercury News for FBI records on the organization is still pending. So we don't know quite how big this group is. The FBI was unwilling to deny, at least, Gale's assertion that he has between 6 and 8 million followers. Skipping down in this same article, about Gale's background. This was in the New York Times article Nip read you via tape a short time ago. Gale said that his version of the biblical story came to him many years ago when he was in a military hospital recovering from a war wound. Gale still has the look of a 1950s-style military, has the look of 1950s military men. His gray hair is cut in a flat-top style, and his body is trim and fit, like that of a man who works at keeping in shape. He said he served on General Douglas MacArthur's staff during World War II and participated in guerrilla operations in the Philippines. Though he retired from the military for health reasons in 1950 at the age of 33, his Army title is still one of his proudest possessions. So, Gale was on the staff of General Douglas MacArthur. Now, again, the MacArthur staff is one of the things that we're going to be looking at through this broadcast and the next one. It appears, so that the MacArthur staff was an epicenter of fascism. MacArthur himself we're not passing judgment on, and obviously we're not casting aspersions on someone who fought under MacArthur in World War II. So if there are any World War II vets out there from the Pacific, you know, we're not casting aspersions on you. We're not even necessarily saying what the story is with General Douglas MacArthur as an individual. Militarily, he had some very sage advice, counseled against the Vietnam War, and is known to have regarded nuclear war with great horror and felt that it simply changed the military situation in the world. On the other hand, he was a political reactionary, and if he was not himself a conscious fascist, then he has to be regarded as one of the stupidest and most gullible people around, because most of the people around him were. And when a man is chief of staff of the Army, it is incumbent upon him to weed that sort of people out, that sort of person out of his immediate company. So again, we're not passing judgment on MacArthur as a person, but his actions and his staff are definitely a dominant force in the generation of American fascism, and William Potter Gale goes back to MacArthur's staff.
Indeed, and we're going to be talking later about, in some detail, about several members of that staff and about their participation or alleged participation in various plots, in fact, coups to overthrow the government of the United States and things of that nature. We're going to be talking about the MacArthur staff at some length. Also, just in passing, I might mention that the biblical interpretation that they said that Potter Gale came up with, his personal biblical interpretation is that Jesus was not a Jew, but was a secret Aryan. So you can figure it out from there. Anyway, okay, back to something that Dave mentioned earlier, not too much earlier, as a matter of fact, which is talking about General Motors and the DuPont family, the controlling interest of General Motors, and something that we have talked about at great length in the past, but have not talked about too much tonight yet. And that is, of course, the connections and the sympathies between leading American industrialists, specifically leading American right-wing industrialists, and Hitler's Germany. And this is a subject, of course, that a great deal of time is put into, and if you were around at the end of May, you may have heard Uncle Sam and the Swastika, or you might have heard it the year before, because it's become sort of an annual tradition around Memorial Day. So that people realize some of the things that were going on behind their backs while American servicemen were fighting and dying in Europe and the Pacific. Anyway, not the premise, but one of the reasons that Uncle Sam the Swastika was put together in the first place is to talk about these kinds of connections, the sympathies, and in many cases the outright business dealings between American industrialists and Western European industrialists and the fascists in Germany and secondarily Italy. Okay, now we're going to be reading several segments here from a book entitled Trading with the Enemy by Charles Higham, H-I-G-H-A-M. And this book is copyright 1983 from Dell. This is a paperback edition. Now, also bear in mind that Charles Higham has written another rather good book that's just come out called American Swastika, which is in hardcover at this point. It is not out in softcover, I don't believe, yet, but is another fascinating book on this general vein. And both of them come highly recommended from Dave and myself. Okay, now, again, though, from trading with the enemy back to the subject of industrial cooperation with fascism, and in fact, downright industrial support for fascism in many cases. Reading from Higham's book. General Motors, under the control of the DuPont family of Delaware, played a part in collaboration comparable with Ford's General Aniline, General Aniline and Film had heavy investments in the company. Irene DuPont was the most imposing and powerful member of the clan. He was obsessed with Hitler's principles. He keenly followed the career of the future Führer in the 1920s, and on September 7, 1926, in a speech to the American Chemical Society, he advocated a race of supermen to be achieved by injecting special drugs into them in boyhood to make their characters to order. He insisted his men reach physical standards equivalent to that of a Marine and have blood as pure as that in the veins of the Vikings. Despite the fact that he had Jewish blood in his own veins, his anti-Semitism matched that of Hitler.
Interrupting the text, remember that's 1926, folks, from Irene DuPont, the founder, the main person in the DuPont family, one of the dominant families, but 1926.
Okay, between 1932 and 1939, bosses of General Motors poured $30 million into IG Farben plants with the excuse that the money could not be exported. IG Farben, for those of you who are not familiar, was the huge German chemical cartel that originally began as a combination of the dyestuffs, the various dyestuffs manufacturers in Germany. And because around the turn of the century, late 19th century, early 20th century, so much of the chemical industry was concerned with dyestuffs and their various byproducts and usages, eventually their control of that market led IG Farben to become one of the biggest and most important commercial chemical manufacturers in the entire world, and by far the most important in Germany and in Europe. And again, we're talking about the connections between General Motors and IG Farben. Later on, IG Farben went on, this is all parenthetically, by the way, this last bit is not out of the book, but later on, IG Farben went on to become a leading backer of Hitler's military machine, one of the leading manufacturers of things to be used for the war machine, and their treatment of, their use of prisoners as slave labor, working them to death at the Auschwitz IG Farben plant, led several members of the IG Farben board of directors to actually be tried as war criminals and convicted, although their sentences were not particularly stringent.
Also, IG Farben's throwing of its support to Hitler is generally regarded as one of the decisive factors in assuring his rise to power.
All right. Again, between 1932 and 1939, bosses of General Motors poured $30 million into IG Farben plants with the excuse that the money could not be exported. On several visits with Hermann Schmitz and Karl Krauch of Farben in Berlin in 1933, Wendell R. Swint, S-W-I-N-T, DuPont's foreign relations director, discovered that IG and the gigantic Krupp industrial empire had arranged for all Nazi industry to contribute 0.5% of its entire wage and salary roll to the Nazis, even before they rose to power. Thus, Swint, who testified to this effect at the 1934 munitions hearings, admitted under oath that DuPont was fully aware it was financing the Nazi Party through 0.5% of its opal wages and salaries, as well as through its deals with IG and its building of armored cars and trucks. Simultaneously with the rise of Hitler, the DuPonts in 1933 began financing native fascist groups in America, including the anti-Semitic and anti-black American Liberty League, and the organization known as Clark's Crusaders, which had 1,250,000 members in 1933. Pierre, Irénée, and Lamotte Dupont, and John Jacob Rascob funded the Liberty League along with Alfred P. Sloan of General Motors. The League smeared Roosevelt as a communist, claimed the president was surrounded by Jews, and, despite the fact that they were Jewish, the DuPonts smeared Semitic organizations. The connections between General Motors and the Nazi government began at the moment of Hitler's rise to power. Goering declined to annex General Motors, and indeed received with pleasure William S. Knudsen, General Motors president, who returned on October 6, 1933, to New York telling reporters that Germany was, quote, the miracle of the 20th century.
Early in 1934, Irénée DuPont and Knudsen reached their explosion point over President Roosevelt. Along with friends of the Morgan Bank and General Motors, recall that the Morgan Financial Group includes DuPont Chemicals, Morgan Bank, and General Motors, beginning again, along with friends of the Morgan Bank and General Motors, certain DuPont backers financed a coup d'etat that would overthrow the president with the aid of a $3 million funded army of terrorists modeled on the fascist movement in Paris known as the Croix de Feu. Who was to be the figurehead for this ill-advised scheme, which would result in Roosevelt being forced to take orders from businessmen as part of a fascist government, or face the alternative of imprisonment and execution? DuPont men allegedly held an urgent series of meetings with the Morgans. They finally settled on one of the most popular soldiers in America, General Smedley Butler of Pennsylvania. Butler, a brave hero, had been awarded 2 Congressional Medals of Honor, and his brilliant career as Commandant of the Marine Corps had made him a legend. He would, the conspiratorial group felt, make an ideal replacement for Roosevelt if the latter proved difficult. These business chiefs found great support for their plan in Hermann Schmitz, Baron von Schroeder, and the other German members of the Fraternity. Interrupting here, the Fraternity is a name that Charles Higham has applied to this cozy group of German and American industrialists and financiers who formed what I guess for lack of a better term we could call this transatlantic financial and industrial axis that essentially was the focus of our Uncle Sam in the broadcast and which we're looking at in part tonight. So that's what Higham means here by the Fraternity. Continuing, the backers of the bizarre conspiracy selected a smooth attorney, Gerald McGuire, to bring word of the plan to General Butler. McGuire agreed Butler would be the perfect choice. Butler had attacked the New Deal in public speeches. McGuire met with Butler at the latter's house in Newton Square, Pennsylvania, and in a hotel suite nearby. With great intensity, the fascist attorney delivered the scheme to the general. Butler was horrified. Although there were many things about Roosevelt he disliked, a coup d'etat amounted to treason, and Butler was nothing if not loyal to the Constitution. However, he disclosed nothing of his feelings. With masterful composure, he pretended interest and waited to hear more. When McGuire returned, it was with news of more millions and more extravagant plans, which included turning America into a dictatorship with Butler as a kind of Hitler. Once more, Butler was infuriated but kept quiet. After McGuire left on the second occasion, the general got in touch with the White House. He told Roosevelt of the entire plan. Roosevelt's state of mind can scarcely be imagined. He knew that in view of the backing from high banking sources, this matter could not be dismissed as some crackpot enterprise that had no chance of success. He was well aware of the powerful forces of fascism that could easily make America an ally of Nazism, even that early, only 1 year after Hitler had risen to power. On the other hand, Roosevelt also knew that if he were to arrest the leaders of the houses of Morgan and DuPont, it would create an unthinkable national crisis in the midst of a depression and perhaps another Wall Street crash. Not for the first or last time in his career, he was aware that there were powers greater than he in the United States. That's worth remembering here that Roosevelt was quite aware that he was not the most powerful man in the country. John Kennedy found that out the hard way. Nevertheless, the plan had to be deactivated immediately. The answer was to leak it to the press. The newspaper ran the story of the attempted coup on the front page, but generally ridiculed it as absurd and preposterous. When Thomas Lamont of the Morgan Bank arrived from Europe by steamer, he was asked by a crowd of reporters to comment. "Perfect moonshine, too utterly ridiculous to comment upon," unquote, was the reply. Roosevelt couldn't quite let the matter rest. Under pressure from liberal Democrats, he set up a special House committee to investigate. Butler begged the committee to summon the DuPonts, but the committee declined, nor would it consent to call anyone from the House of Morgan. Then Butler dropped a bombshell. He gave interviews to the press announcing that none other than General Douglas MacArthur was a party to the plot. This again was dismissed by the press, and MacArthur laughed it off. interrupting here, MacArthur was chief of staff of the Army. That's one of the reasons this was such a bombshell. Before Niptuck continues here, note here that we have some of the most powerful financiers and industrialists in America financing a proposed military coup d'etat. This is a matter of public record, although the record has been obscured. It's worth underscoring the point here because most Americans don't really think of the United States as a place where a military coup might take place. And our point is that this has been attempted in the past.
Okay. The committee hearings were a farce. McGuire was allowed to get away with saying that Butler had, quote, misunderstood his intentions. Other witnesses lamely made excuses, and there the matter rested. It was 4 years before the committee dared to publish its report in a white paper that was marked for, quote, restricted circulation. They were forced to admit that, quote, certain persons made an attempt to establish a fascist organization in this country. The committee was able to verify all the pertinent statements made by General Butler, unquote. This admission that the entire plan was deadly in intent was not accompanied by the imprisonment of anybody. Further investigations disclosed that over 1 million people had been guaranteed to join the scheme, and that the arms and munitions necessary would have been supplied by Remington, a DuPont subsidiary. The DuPont's fascistic behavior was seen in 1936, when Irene DuPont used General Motors money to finance the notorious Black Legion. This terrorist organization had as its purpose the prevention of automobile workers from unionizing. The members wore hoods and black robes with skull and crossbones. They firebombed union meetings, murdered union organizers, often by beating them to death, and dedicated their lives to destroying Jews and communists. They linked to the Ku Klux Klan. Irene DuPont encouraged General Motors foremen to join the Legion. In one episode, a Detroit worker, Charles Poole, was brutally murdered by a gang of black Legionists, several of whom belonged to the sinister Wolverine Republican League of Detroit. This organization had as its members several in big business. However, their names were kept out of the papers during the Poole case trial. It was brought out at the last that at least 50 people, many of them blacks, had been butchered by the Legion, which swept through General Motors factories and had 75,000 members. At the same time, the DuPonts developed the American Liberty League, a Nazi organization whipping up hatred of blacks and Jews, love of Hitler, and loathing of the Roosevelts. Financed by Lamont and Irene to the tune of close to $500,000 the first year, the Liberty League had a lavish 31-room office in New York, branches in 26 colleges, and 15 subsidiary organizations nationwide that distributed 50 million copies of its Nazi pamphlets. In September 1936, while Hitler at Nuremberg expressed his grand design for the four-year plan, the DuPonts and the American Liberty League poured thousands into backing Republican Alf Landon against Roosevelt in that election. Other backers were the American Nazi Party and the German-American Bund. I should just mention that, I'll mention later on. Go ahead.